Great, thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you to the library for having me out. I'm here with my son, Honest Ben, one of our faithful supporters and sometimes players. Ben practices with us sometimes. So I'm here to talk about the pastime of vintage baseball. You might be here because you're a baseball fan, or maybe you're into history, or maybe you're just looking at something unique. And really, I think vintage baseball hits all three of those categories. It's a unique thing to participate in, to come out and watch. And I think it has something for fans of all ages and all interest levels. I'm the captain of the Monitor Baseball Club of Chelsea, Michigan. We are about to start our sixth season here in town, in Chelsea. And we actually, as Sarah mentioned, a couple of years ago had a sister club, the Merrimack, or the Marys, startup in honor of the names, I should say, are in reference to the Civil War battleships, the Monitor and the Merrimack. The Monitors, our club, is actually the name of a real baseball club from Chelsea's history. And in case I forget to mention it later on, there were other clubs, including one in Ann Arbor, called the Monitor Baseball Club. In 1862, there was actually a Monitor Baseball Club of Ann Arbor, which is kind of an interesting factoid. I'll go through some photos here and share a little bit about the history of baseball, a little bit about the modern pastime of vintage baseball, which is sort of a recreating the time period and using the rules from the 1860s. And I've got a lot of equipment here for you to take a look at. So we'll go ahead and get started here. I'll go back to my first slide. We were talking about this before the presentation. This is actually a modern picture taken a couple of years ago in downtown Chelsea in what would be an illegal activity, standing on the railroad tracks. But this is us in our uniforms in front of the clock tower. One of the fun things about the pastime is things like this, the opportunity to dress the part, to not only play the sport, but also kind of bring that history to life. So a lot of times we'll take historic photos like this and make them look like a tintype. Here's our club photograph from last year. Same sort of idea. We wanted to look the part as well as playing the game. So we're the Monitors. Here's the club photo, including our dear Sarah, half pint, from last year. As you can tell back then, not many people smiled for the photograph, so we tried to recreate that as well. This was taken at a match that we actually both the Monitors and the Marys played last year. Usually we try to coordinate our schedules, and it's really a lot of fun to have everybody all together. I like to think of the clubs as not just a sports team, but it's almost like a social club. So we all get along well and enjoy playing together. And this last photo here in the opening was actually a match sponsored by the Ann Arbor District Library that took place at Cobblestone Farm last September, which was really a great location for the pastime. We played out in the front lawn there. We didn't hit any balls into the farm itself. We were very happy about that, but it was really a great time. You'll notice a couple of guys in this photograph have a different uniform, have that gray and blue with a D on it. That's the Dexter Union, another vintage club in the area, and they are starting their fifth year this year, so they've been around almost as long as we have. This is a fun match we played where we just split up teams and played for the fun of it, so we mixed players from all three of our squads, and that's really the spirit of the whole pastime is really emphasizing having fun and enjoying what we're doing. So a quick little discussion of what this pastime of vintage baseball is before we get into the history of baseball. What these clubs like the Monitors and the Marys and the Dexter Union are trying to do is bring back the rules, bring you back to when the sport of baseball was first being organized and the rules were being written down, a code of comportment and a code of gameplay. The oldest clubs, actually, so we're 6 years old. The oldest vintage baseball clubs are about 30, 35 years old. A club that we played last year from Columbus, Ohio, just finished its 35th year. So it's actually been going on for quite a while. Michigan has almost 40 different clubs. So there's a lot of towns kind of clustered. I have a map a little bit later that shows where these clubs are, but it's really growing in popularity. Every few years, new clubs are popping up. And they're all basically, our goal is the same, to bring back the customs and the rules of the 1860s in the form of a dynamic game of baseball. It's a beautiful thing because there is no league or anything. It's all amateur. We're playing for the fun of it. Basically, the way we organize a season is we call each other up and put together games. So we're not accountable to any sort of governing body, and that makes it all very much for fun. So we all know each other, and I should say, because we're playing for fun, you might think we don't take the gameplay itself seriously, but the games actually are really competitive. There's a lot of different clubs of different abilities, and we all kind of know a little bit about talent level, and we try to put together games that are evenly matched. So when you come to a vintage game, you're seeing a very dynamic and unscripted actual game of baseball. I like to think of it as part historical reenactment, part pickup game of baseball. And I like to think it also, it supersedes something like Civil War reenactment, where they are, you might go and watch a mock battle, but they're not actually shooting at each other. We're kind of doing the same thing. We're taking you back to that time period, but we are playing a legitimate game of baseball. And I think for the spectator, that is really a draw, because you're not only almost, you could squint your eyes and imagine you're back in the time period, but you're also seeing a viable game that's exciting and has a lot of twists and turns. Now, I'm not a baseball historian. I've done some reading about the origins of the game of baseball. If you're interested, I have a lot of good books here that I can recommend. The gist of the history of baseball has been kind of a controversial one for a while. In history, people have at different times wanted to come up with some sort of a fascinating story about how the sport of baseball was created. And in fact, a lot of myths and legends have been told about how the sport was created and how the rules were first written. Basically, what most historians and baseball experts agree about now is that it's a sport that over time has evolved over many years and through different, slightly different forms of the same basic game came together. People started writing down rules, and those rules became accepted by more and more places and more teams, evolving into the sport that we know of as baseball. I've got some photos of some earlier bat and ball games. In the upper left is the game of cricket, which came over from England. On the upper right is this is a little more of a modern photo, but that's a group of gentlemen playing town ball, which was a bat and ball game with a similar goal of hitting a ball and reaching a base, a safe haven base. In the early 19th century, games like town ball were real popular. Everywhere you went, there was a form of a bat and ball game like this. The rules, though, were pretty all over the board. There was no standard for the rules. But around the 1840s, 1850s, groups of gentlemen started getting together to have some exercise and do something enjoyable, and they started becoming a little more serious about it. Prior to then, it was a lot of children who would play the game. And around 1830s, 1840s, groups of gentlemen looking for some exercise would put together these clubs. And one of the first clubs, which we'll see in a second here, that started to write down rules was the Knickerbocker Baseball Club in New York. This is a photograph of some of the original members. In 1845, they published their first set of rules. And this is one of the groups that has been falsely attributed with coming up with the rules of baseball. They were a group of guys who essentially compiled rules that other clubs had been playing by, and they were one of the first clubs to write down those rules. And so some historians over time have given them, certain members or the club itself, the credit for creating the game of baseball. And now we understand that they're more of a group that just consolidated and wrote down, published the rules, and began disseminating the rules. So Alexander Cartwright is the gentleman in the upper, in the center. He has been called the father of baseball, as I said before, but it's sort of a false term, because he was just one of a group of people who came up with and wrote down, copied down the rules that had been in play for a while. But nevertheless, they're one of the first clubs to have played. This picture on the right-hand side is the Elysian Fields in New Jersey, which is a field where they would go and play. They were a club based out of New York City. And they would go over and play their matches in the only open space they could find. And Elysian Fields was one of them. There's a funny story that the first official game that they played against some, by their rules, they played against a group of cricket players, and they got destroyed, like 25-1 or something. So they were real enthusiastic and great guys. Actually, one of the gentlemen, I believe it's in the bottom, in the center, I believe that's Doc Adams. Some of these guys had different roles and have been, also been claimed to be fathers of baseball. Doc Adams, the gentleman in the front row in the center, his great-great-granddaughter is... in the past few years has really been advocating for him to be included in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And she is a big follower, this woman, is a big follower of vintage baseball. And so she lives out in New York or something, and she is very active on Facebook. So she follows our club, and she posts things, and she posts as him, as Doc Adams. She has a Facebook personality as him. But these, and he's actually, I believe, his sort of claim to fame was, as the legend goes, coming up with the position of the shortstop, which I've always found kind of fascinating, because it kind of seems like the shortstop position was pretty essential. You know, there must have been someone playing right there. I know when I hit a baseball, it almost always goes to where the shortstop would be. So the fact that maybe I should have played back in that era when there wasn't a shortstop. But that's his claim to fame. There's another good photograph of the Knickerbocker Club all lined up. You can see how serious they are. But they were serious about making this a viable pastime through the rules. A couple more gentlemen back in the time period that I'll touch on briefly. This is Henry Chadwick, who is an Englishman. Who lived in New York, who grew up playing cricket and rounders, another bat and ball game that came over from England. And he was really an enthusiast of those sports and those pastimes until he came across this new pastime of baseball, and he really got hooked. One of the things that he didn't like about the rounders and town ball that was played in a lot of cities in the time period was the rule that allowed for a runner to be put out by getting hit by the ball. That was called soaking or burning. And in a predecessor of baseball, you could get the runner out by corralling the ball that he hit and throwing it at him and hitting him. That would put him out. And Chadwick really didn't care for that. And groups like the Knickerbockers, in their sets of rules. They got rid of that rule. There was one reason that he enjoyed it. He was kind of a scientific guy, so he enjoyed the very detailed sets of rules that they came up with. And he became not just an admirer, but an advocate for the sport. He was a journalist who would write about games. He was an editor of this Beatles Dime baseball player, which was distributed throughout the country, that shared the rules, shared a little bit of the spirit and the history of the early game. And it's quite obvious that by disseminating all of this, that was part of how the pastime grew into a national obsession and became the national pastime. One of Chadwick's claims to fame that we accept now is that he basically came up with the box score. Here's a sample of a box score from his time period, which allowed you to almost replay the game in your head. You could see the statistics, you could compare players, you could compare players over a season, over different years. He actually would write much more detailed box scores than this, where you really could break down the action. And for someone who maybe wasn't as athletic, but liked to follow the game action, these box scores were really appealing. So this is one of his contributions. The next two gentlemen I'd like to mention, the guy on the left here is Albert Spalding, who originally was a player and a very good player. He played in Boston, was a pitcher who won something like 80% of his games, one of the most dominant players in his time period, and he was also a very shrewd business person. He negotiated a contract. He was playing in the professional era of baseball as professional ball was starting, and he negotiated a contract where he got like 25% of the gate to the games that he played in. So he was a very smart businessman, and after he retired from playing, he became an advocate for the sport of baseball, as well as a businessman. This is the Spalding from the sporting goods store. But he really wanted to grow the sport for his own personal interest, but also because he loved it. You know, he wanted it to be our national pastime. I put him up here because he's another person credited with being a father of baseball. He was indeed a very influential person, but around the turn of the century, 1906 or so, Chadwick, the gentleman from the last slide, the Englishman who fell in love with baseball, published an article about the origins of baseball, and he claimed that it came from, kind of like how we accept now, it came from those earlier bat and ball games like cricket and rounders. And Spalding didn't like that. He didn't like that this American sport didn't have its genesis here in our country. And so he and some others put together a commission of influential people, a few congressmen, and some judges, I believe, called the Mills Commission. And their task was to find a more American genesis story for the game of baseball. And what they came up with, the Mills Commission in 1906, 1907, they claimed that the gentleman on the right here, Abner Doubleday, was the true father of baseball. And you might have heard, have you heard of Abner Doubleday? Abner Doubleday is from Cooperstown, New York. You've probably heard of Cooperstown, where the Hall of Fame is. According to this commission in 1907, Abner Doubleday, in 1839, had an epiphany and sat down and wrote the rules of baseball. Came up with the positions, 90-foot base pass, three outs to an inning, all of the rules that we know of as baseball. And basically, it was all a lie. It was all made up. They had, as their evidence, the recollections of a childhood friend of Doubleday's, who said, oh yeah, back in 1839, Abner came up with it and wrote down the rules. And it was all just an elaborate hoax, almost. so that they could claim that the sport of baseball had its roots here in America. Now, Doubleday, this is kind of an injustice to him because he was an important man in history. He was a Civil War general who was at both Fort Sumter and Gettysburg. He went on after the war. He moved out to San Francisco, and he took out the first patent on the cable car in San Francisco. So he has some very legitimate claims to history. Virtually nothing to do with baseball, though. I think the most they found in his writings about baseball was a letter or something when he was in the Army requesting some baseball equipment for his troops. So another myth and legend about the origins of the game. There's a lot more to it. Like I said, I'm not an expert on baseball history, but there's a lot of excellent books, including, I brought a couple with me. You might have seen the documentary simply called Baseball by Ken Burns. If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend it. It's a 10-part video documentary. This is the book companion that goes with it, and they go through this in a lot of detail, including a whole chapter on early baseball in the time period that we're recreating. And then John Thorne, who is the official historian of Major League Baseball now, who's very active in retracing the authentic beginnings of baseball, wrote a book called Baseball in the Garden of Eden. And this one is super detailed and breaks down some of those first clubs and first influential gentlemen who set down the rules, and also debunks a lot of the myths, like the Doubleday myth. So I highly recommend those. And I'll talk about this gentleman again later on, but we're very lucky here in Michigan to have one of the most preeminent baseball historians, Peter Morris, who is from Lansing, who has written lots of books about baseball history, including a comprehensive book about early baseball in Michigan. So if you're interested in history, you're interested in baseball, especially here in our state, this is essential reading. This one's called Baseball Fever, Early Baseball in Michigan. And a lot of the research that we have presented with our teams was done by Peter Morris. He's really done a fantastic job. I've put together just a quick little sample of what's been found about baseball history in Chelsea, but you could really go back to any town, including Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor has a rich history of baseball in the time period, and you could find some fascinating snippets from newspapers about baseball. This is the first evidence that was found of baseball in Chelsea. This comes from 1861, where the first club organized was the Union Baseball Club. You can see a lot of personality here. They organized their first game last Friday. It was a most splendid game and conducted with strictness according to the code. So you could tell they were trying to not just play a fun game, but they were trying to behave a certain way, conduct themselves a certain way. And that's kind of the spirit that we now, these days, in vintage baseball, are also trying to recreate, not just the baseball action. This club, the Union Baseball Club, we don't know how long they lasted. This is really the only newspaper clipping we've found from 1861. The next evidence of baseball in Chelsea is the club that we took our name from, the Monitor Baseball Club. And this is from 1867. You'll see on the right-hand side a couple of box scores here of Chelsea versus Dexter games. One thing you might notice, that upper right-hand box score, for example, you might notice the score. The final score of that game was 67-61. Not a typical score that you would see in modern baseball. It was really an offensive game originally, and there's a few reasons for that. Originally, the pitcher's job in baseball was to give the hitter a pitch he could hit. Nowadays, the pitcher is trying to limit the hitter, trying to strike him out. Back then, in the original sets of rules, his job was to deliver a ball that could be put in play, so you saw a lot more scoring. I really like that box score because the Chelsea team got out to a 34-4 lead in the first two innings. But the Dexter team came back, and in fact, I'm not sure you can read it, but they scored 22 runs in the bottom of the ninth and still lost. But it was quite an effort there. They didn't give up. I love the clipping underneath that. It's pretty morbid. The baseball score immediately follows reporting of a man who was hit by a train, which I thought was kind of insensitive to this gentleman who was hit by a train. But moving right on to the baseball, another high score. And actually, another very fascinating clipping from 1867 is this long one here on the left about a baseball picnic or festival that was organized in Chelsea in that year that invited a lot of the area clubs. I'm not sure you can make out the names, but you have the Unknown Baseball Club of Jackson, the Ann Arbor Seniors, the Peninsulars of Ypsilanti, the Rough and Readies of Stockbridge, and clubs from Grass Lake and Dexter. This is kind of a fun one to read because the writer is talking about the unknowns from Jackson who were invited to this festival in Chelsea refused to show up. They didn't come. And prior to this, they had participated in another tournament and won. And they found that after they won a tournament, I believe it was in Detroit, they were invited to a lot more tournaments because clubs wanted to challenge them and beat the champions. And so they declined to come. People were excited to see the unknowns from Jackson come to Chelsea to take on the other powerhouse team, the Ann Arbor Seniors. And the unknowns did not come. And actually, there's a newspaper clipping just after this one that takes the side of the Jackson team, saying, well, should we have to accept every invitation to play now that we're the champions? And it's real snarky and kind of a fun read, but you see that these clubs were competitive and they took a lot of pride in playing well. I'll mention, because we're in Ann Arbor, the Ann Arbor Seniors that day played quite well. They beat Dexter 53-24 and then beat the Chelsea team 28-5. So it looks like there was some very exciting action that took place that day. And actually, this clipping on the left here was kind of the inspiration for us in Chelsea. Last year, we organized a festival of vintage baseball that we played in July of last year, and we had 12 different teams into Chelsea for an all-day festival of vintage baseball.
It was a really hot day with the tornado.
It was a really hot day. Yeah, we're still recovering. Yeah, we took a chance. It was July 18th, took a chance on the weather. It was not only extremely hot, but at lunchtime, basically a tornado passed through town. We managed to play all of the games, but I can tell you that we were all quite weary at the end, as Sarah will attest to as well. It was a long day, but a lot of fun. All right, a couple more from Chelsea here. So that was the Monitor Baseball Club from 1867. No evidence between them. We don't know how long, when the Monitor started, how long they lasted. It appears that these clubs would sort of pop up and then disband after a while. Or maybe just we haven't found more history of those clubs. Here's the third evidence of baseball in Chelsea from the same basic time period, from 1875, a little bit later. And this is simply the Chelsea Baseball Club. So another amateur team. Again, these are not professional. This is an amateur town team here. There's a couple of clippings that mention a team in Stockbridge, a club in Pinckney. So you can see that virtually all of the neighboring towns, a lot of them anyway, would have their own clubs. And mostly the action, the gameplay was local. So you had local competition. I want to draw your attention to the clipping on the bottom right. This is really a fascinating clip that shows a lot of bias, a lot of journalistic bias here. This is a clipping that talks about the Chelsea Baseball Club playing what was called a scrub nine. They played a game with a scrub nine. Scrub nine was, this is what they would call back then, a muffin match. A muffin was a player who wasn't maybe all that good or all that experienced with baseball. And clubs would play groups of townsfolk from their village in a fun game. In Chelsea, apparently, they called them the Scrubs, which I don't know if that had the same sort of connotation back then that it does now, but doesn't seem like the nicest name. The Chelsea team beat them 22-12, and the writer of this article says, "We're surprised that the Scrubs didn't come out ahead." Apparently, he or she thought that Chelsea team should have put them away by a much larger score. So there's a lot of personality there. The next day, the Chelsea played the Stockbridge Club and actually lost a close game, 19-18. And basically, whoever wrote this clipping just tears into them. Yeah, advises the club to give their caps to their little brothers and let them use them in playing soldier. They'd better give their pants to their mothers to make carpet rags of, and they should let their mothers have their clubs for a pudding stick, for it is very evident they can't play ball.
They lost by one.
They lost by one run, yeah. It's a really tough crowd.
You know?
Yeah, I would hate to have to perform for this person, but this sort of personality in the description is very indicative of the time period. You know, you saw a lot of, kind of like now, how soccer matches are described. If you read about soccer matches in Europe, it's not just a recap of the game. There's all sorts of opinion passed on the team and the players and a lot of personality. This is a photo from a couple of years ago. We decided that we liked the idea of the scrub game, and we put together a match, with a group of folks from town that we called the Scrub Nine. And we've actually played a number of games now in the past few years, the Monitors versus the Scrubs. And they are, we have representatives from the schools, from some local businesses, some sponsors of our team, and they play quite well and they have a great time with it. It's really kind of part of our core mission, is just having fun with the sport. So this is just from a couple of years ago. Pretty hot day as well. I think we might have bested them that day, but they performed admirably. I've just got a couple more clippings from a little bit later here in Chelsea. This clipping on the left kind of points to some of the dangers of playing baseball. This is a gentleman who was hit in the mouth someone who was batting let go of the bat, slipped out and hit this gentleman, George Kempf, across the mouth, knocked out all of his front teeth. So no real recap of the game itself, but of an accident that took place. Here's another clipping from 1881 with a Manchester club and a Clinton club, some more local clubs. A prize of $10 for the winner. A couple more fun ones we found. This clipping from 1886 has a junior and a senior baseball club in Chelsea. And then that third paragraph, the Dexter folks are kicking vigorously on Sunday ball playing. Good for them. Hope they will make the boys quit it. It is a disgraceful thing to desecrate the Sabbath day by such sports. Isn't that one kind of funny? And then this is an editorial on the right-hand side, the Chelsea and Dexter baseball game. This is obviously a response to a prior recap of the game, very defensive reaction to what was written about the game, submitted by this gentleman, George Crane, who's correcting a report. Basically, the team was said to have forfeited the game and quit, but he's refuting that. So people took a lot of pride in their local clubs. These clippings are actually from Ann Arbor. Again, here's a woman who was killed at a game, struck on the head by a baseball on the corner of Liberty and Fifth.
Wow.
Liberty and Fifth, which is
yeah.
right over here. Yeah. So I will say that this is a good time to talk about baseball in Ann Arbor. Baseball in Ann Arbor goes all the way back to 1860. Like I said, right around the same time period that it started up. I think the first local club was a team in Ypsilanti in 1859, but Ann Arbor, Chelsea, Dexter, these clubs followed immediately after. 1860 was an Ann Arbor club. I believe it might have been the Monitor Club, or that might have been 1862. There was also a club in Ann Arbor called the Ericssons, and Erickson was the gentleman who designed the Monitor ironclad warship. So there were names that were chosen because they were very patriotic. Obviously, we're back in that time period was the middle of the Civil War, the beginnings of the Civil War, and to call your team the Monitor or the Union or even the Ericssons after a patriot was actually a Swedish guy, but he obviously was contributing to the Union effort in the Civil War that was very much desired. So the University of Michigan also had clubs that predate the university's actual athletic teams. So the University of Michigan had a club baseball team that came before its official varsity baseball team. So back in the 1860s, they had their own club team. And there, if you remember back to the clipping I showed from 1867 that talked about the Ann Arbor Seniors, which was really one of the strongest teams back then, the Ann Arbor Seniors, one of the reasons why they were so good is they actually utilized a couple of players from the university squad. And they caught a lot of flack for that. They weren't the only club that did that, that brought in some ringers. But some of the other clubs were populated by older gentlemen who couldn't keep up with the young guys and who expected that the teams they were playing would be put together the same way, would have the same demographics. But teams started to get a little more competitive and brought in ringers. So even back then, it was a fiercely competitive pastime. This, I was explaining before the presentation, this is the only photograph we've really managed to find of baseball in Chelsea. This is a shot of Main Street, downtown in Chelsea. I've blown up, there's a detail in the upper spot here that's the banner that's going across Main Street. And you can see it says baseball today, Chelsea versus, and we don't know who the opponent was that day. You might notice that baseball is spelled as two words, and that was the original way that baseball was spelled as two separate words. But I don't even know what year this photo is from. It's obviously we've got a dirt road here. But we are hoping to unearth more photographs of early baseball, not only in Chelsea, but in neighboring towns. One reason I would like to find some actual photographs from Chelsea is because I'd love to be able to recreate not only the name of the team, but the look of the team. You'll see I'm wearing what we wear in our games now. This is what we came up with for a uniform, basically a dress shirt, a sash, and work pants. We wear wool caps. This is a recreated style pillbox cap that was used back then. But in the absence of any photograph of the actual Monitor team or the Union team from Chelsea, we had to come up with what we thought they might be wearing. And this, to us, seemed like what you might find, somebody might throw together to put together a team in the time period. Basically what you have on hand, work pants, a dress shirt, or any kind of flannel shirt or something. So one of our goals, not only in addition to playing the baseball and putting on matches and events, is to bring some of the history back to life. So hopefully we can find a photograph of an early team from the time period. There's a a picture actually in this book by Peter Morris of the Ann Arbor team. I believe it's taken in 1865, Ann Arbor team, and a team from Dexter called the Wahoo Baseball Club of Dexter. And they're all wearing uniforms that looked a lot like this. So that was our inspiration for what we wear in our matches. So that's a little bit of baseball's history, a little bit of history in Chelsea. And now we'll move on to what we're doing now, this pastime of vintage baseball. Here's a photograph taken a couple of years ago up on Mackinac Island. We've played there a couple of times. This gentleman on the right, who goes by the nickname of Gypsy, I'll get to our nicknames in a second, we all take a moniker, is a vintage baseball enthusiast. And he was the head of security at the Grand Hotel until a couple of years ago, and he invited clubs up to Mackinac Island to play. So it was really a thrill for us. We got to go up there a couple of times. We played a team from Petoskey. We played a team from over by Grand Rapids. And another team a little bit closer to the west side, to the west coast of Michigan. But a great time there. One of the downsides of our pastime is the travel, but it's also one of the more exciting things. We've been able to go all around the state playing baseball. Here's a couple more photographs and some of our mission. As I said, this is our sixth year. We'll be starting our sixth year. It's a fascinating pastime, in part because of the atmosphere, the tone, the spirit of play. We try to make it fun and family friendly. I really believe that there's something that fans of all ages will find enjoyable when they come to watch a game. Here's some photographs of games we played. We've had fathers and sons playing together. This is actually my son Ben here in the middle, and that's my mother batting. So he was the pinch runner for my mother. There's me marching in a parade with my other son Henry. It's a fantastic, almost more of a social club that's bringing together friends and neighbors and family. I believe we've had 8 different fathers and sons play with our team, and that's very common in these clubs. A lot of times you'll have 3 generations playing together, which is really a lot of fun. This photo on the bottom right was from a couple of years ago. We invited some senior residents from the Chelsea retirement community out to a game. They live just a mile or so away from our home field, and we're able to provide them, and we've had them back a few other times, we're able to provide them with some local, unique, and very accessible entertainment, and we're really happy about doing that. That's really the goal of what we're doing in the community. We're hoping to create an authentic display of baseball as it would have been played in the time period, but we don't want it to be like a lecture. We don't want to, and I hope I'm doing it justice now, talking about it. There's only so much you can see, you can say about it. It's really fascinating to be at a game and to see it come to life. And through that, we're trying to create evenly matched games where the actual baseball action is very compelling. Obviously, we're promoting interest in Chelsea and the history of Chelsea, the history of baseball in Chelsea. Every club is trying to do that for its own town. And we're trying to be very interactive. I've got the word cranks on there. Cranks is a term that we use sometimes for the fans. So you would be cranks at a game. I'll touch on the lingo in a minute. But our goal is not just to play a game in front of you and not talk about it or not share or teach you about the game or the rules. Our goal is to really bring you into it. So during the game, as things happen, we try to explain why whatever happened that way, what the rule was back then. You might have noticed some difference from modern baseball, and our goal is really to share that as it happens. I put sportsmanship on there because that's really at the core of the whole pastime. And it's very important to me as the club captain that this is first and foremost. Especially I have 3 young children, I love that they see this pastime. It's not sportsmanship like we have in our game is not something you see necessarily in sports these days at any level. Professional sports, obviously, if you watch baseball, you watch the NFL now, those guys are trying to injure each other. They're trying to win at all costs. We're trying to play hard and win, but we're playing with friends. We're playing with a group that we respect, and we are very free and open with acknowledging that the other team made a great play and congratulating them and cheering for our friends for making good plays. And that's just not something you see even at down to a high school or Little League level. You know, there's a lot of cutthroat competitiveness in sports these days, and this is kind of a welcome alternative to that. Here's a quick graphic on some of the other clubs in Michigan. I did this graphic a couple of years ago, and there's a few more clubs that have popped up since then. But you can see there's a lot of clubs. These are just the men's clubs, too. I don't have the Marys on here. There are at least four different ladies' clubs in Michigan. There's one in Detroit, Chelsea. There's one, or two, actually, on the West Coast in the Benton Harbor area. And we're going to be traveling to Benton Harbor this year to play them. But all around, kind of clusters of teams. There's a new club this year that started up in Canton, who is going to be coming into Chelsea, the Corn Shuckers. You see some pretty creative names here. We have played probably half of these teams. They're all basically trying to do the same thing, recreate the time period, play competitive games, but they all have their own personalities, and you get to know them over time. Some are much more into the gameplay itself and much more competitive, and a lot younger than we are in Chelsea, so we try not to always have games with teams that are going to throttle us. But it is fun to play, and it's fun to see baseball played by those rules very well. Has anyone been to Greenfield Village to see vintage baseball played? Have you ever been to a vintage match?
No, we haven't.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Greenfield Village, which is a place that we play at every year, and most of these clubs will make a trip there, if you can't get to a local match, is a great place to go because they do a fantastic job of presenting a game but also educating you. They have a gentleman mic'd up during the game, usually with a pretty big crowd, a couple hundred spectators, and this gentleman will explain as the game's going on the different rules. So he'll wait for something to happen, like a foul ball that was caught on one bounce, according to the rules that they play there at Greenfield Village, that would be an out. So instead of, before the game, going over all the rules, he'll wait for it to happen, because it's probably going to happen during the game, and he'll take that opportunity to talk about the different rules. So it's a great place. They do a fantastic job of promoting the pastime and the spirit of the game there. We're actually going to be playing there for the third year in a row at a tournament in mid-August where they bring in clubs from around Michigan, Ohio, Indiana. We're kind of the Washington Generals of that tournament. We're there. We're kind of dog meat. We go there to get beat and make the other teams feel good about themselves. But it's fun to be there. Real quickly, this is a little bit about what you would see, and hopefully you do come to a game, if not a game in Chelsea, in Dexter, or Greenfield Village, or wherever. This is kind of what you would see. We line up before the game. This photo here is actually, you'll see three different teams. This is a team from Royal Oak, and us in Chelsea, and then the Dexter team on the right. On occasion, we'll play a game that pits three different sides against each other. We'll play one game with three teams, and we kind of rotate in and out of the field. We call it a Gatling gun, after the Civil War era weapon. It's just a fun way to get more people involved and keep a compelling game going. What you'll see either at a Gatling gun or a game between two teams, we'll line up, we'll introduce ourselves, we'll all say our nicknames and tip our caps to you in the crowd and greet you, thank you for coming. Originally, there was no rule that said that the visiting team, like in modern baseball, would bat first, would strike first. So what we'll either do is a coin flip, or we'll toss a bat between the captains who will work their hands up the bat, and whoever can grasp the knob first, that captain will decide whether he wants to hit or take the field first. We play in a standard 9-inning game. Basically, all of the rules, I believe, I'll be talking about the rules in just a second here. It's very recognizable as baseball. A lot of the rules are very similar, if not exactly the same as modern baseball. After the game, we'll line up as well again, and thank you for coming, congratulate each other. And usually the expectation is we feed the opposing club. So it's really a spirit of community and fellowship. Here's a little primer on the terminology that we use, the lingo. As you can see, they're pretty creative and fun to say. We call a game a match. We as hitters are called strikers, the pitchers are called hurlers, the catcher is called the behind. You as the fans, we refer to you sometimes as cranks or bugs or rooters. We call a bat a willow and the ball is a pill. We don't say outs during the game. You'll hear us say one hand dead or two hands dead. So a hand would be an out. And dead would be put out. So if you'll hear that said during the game, and everybody goes through it when they get to know this pastime, they go through that learning curve of what are they talking about? What is this hands dead? But it's just kind of a fun way to spice up what we're doing. You as fans are encouraged to cheer for both teams and offer them a huzzah or a well struck, sir, well held for a fine catch. When I started Vintage Baseball about 10 years ago, they really pushed this lingo and this terminology. And we kind of have, Vintage clubs have taken a step back. And we offer a little bit of a disclaimer now because the people who are involved in the pastime who are really purists about the authenticity aspect aren't thrilled with this terminology. And in fact, a lot of research has been done that has shown that these terms were either hardly ever used, were used in a much different time period, you know, not until the 1880s or the 1900s, or were never used and were just another fabrication. And there's a lot of consternation amongst clubs like ours about why it is, because we are trying to be authentic. And we're trying to show you, we're telling you, this is what baseball was like in the 1860s, but yet we're using these terms that may or may not have ever been used or nearly as much as we use them. So my opinion is that they're fun and they add to, you know, the spectacle of it. And I acknowledge that they may not be authentic to the 1860s, but in my opinion, it's not a huge deal. There are some clubs who, there's really, in the past 2, 3, 4 years, there's been a huge backlash against this lingo. So perhaps in a few years, we will come around to and change our minds about it, but I think it's fun. I think it's fun to use terms that are historical. I mean, these things were, most of them were said at some point in early baseball, but maybe not as frequently as we use them. Here are a couple of the key rules. Like I said, vintage baseball, the rules from 1860, it's largely recognizable from the baseball that you watch now in terms of the way the field looks, the distance between the bases, where the players are, three outs to a side, nine players out in the field. That's all the same, but there are some key differences that you'll see at a game that we put on. And I should say that in Chelsea, the Monitors and the Marys, we play by the rules of 1860. There are clubs that play by rules from 1858, which is a slightly, there's a few differences from what we play by. And there are clubs that choose 1864 or 1867 rules that have some subtle differences. The big one that you'll notice right off the bat is that we don't use gloves. So we are playing with, I invite you to come take a look at these after the presentation. This is the ball that we use. This is a modern ball, but it's made in the style that the balls were back then. It's actually quite hard when we first use it, and we're supposed to start a game with a brand new ball. And there's some big boys and ladies who know how to hit the ball really hard. So in the first inning of a game with a brand new ball, it's really put into play with a lot of force. So you have to be very careful about how you attempt to catch or avoid a ball hit in your direction. It's a fascinating thing both for the players to try to relearn how to catch a ball. And we all grew up with a glove, holding our hand out from our body, maybe to catch it, away from our heads. And now we're trying to catch a ball coming basically the same speed without benefit of a glove. And it's a fun thing for the players. It's fun for the spectators because there's an element of danger there and an intrigue, whether they're going to catch it, whether they're going to get hurt. I tend to catch it. I play in the outfield, and I tend to catch it like football. I bring it into my chest. So actually, a lot of times, I'll let a ball hit my sternum. If I don't handle it cleanly, it'll come off my chest. And I found that's what works best for myself. But players, everybody's got their own style. I've seen a guy who only catches with one hand. I've seen people hold both hands out like a lobster and just catch it like this, way up above their head. It's fun. I say there's an element of danger, and hopefully nobody does get hurt, but invariably there are some injuries. I have several broken fingers as a result of this pastime. Both times I made the catch, however, which I'm very happy about. But that's just something we accept, and over time we learn how to catch. And for me, I find that to be a really fun thing because it's more of a question of repetition and practice. And it's not necessarily the best athletes. You don't have to be an elite athlete to learn how to catch the ball this way. And some of our best players don't have a whole lot of history of playing baseball. And they've through playing with us and practicing with us, they've come to be great players because they practiced it. In that way, I think it's a very inclusive sport, and I'm really happy about that. So we call this first rule the bound rule. Back in 1860, and rules that were written before that time period, originally you could get the striker, the batter, out either by catching the ball in the air or after the first bounce, which was called the bound. So if you think about that, if you're out in the field, if I'm playing the outfield, I might choose to let the ball land and try to catch it after one bounce, which anyone who's played, and Sarah, you can attest to this, isn't always as easy as it sounds. It does bring the chance of hurting yourself down quite a bit, but a lot of times the ball will hit an uneven part of the ground, or if the ground is wet at all, it might not bounce up. To me, it adds an element of strategy. If you can get it in the air, you go for it. If you think there's no way you can, you still have an opportunity to get the batter out by catching it on the bound. Clubs like ours, a lot of clubs who are maybe a little bit older, choose to play by the bound rule. Some of the clubs in Michigan and around the country that are a lot more competitive and a lot younger choose to play by later sets of rules, like I said, before 1864, 1867. And at that point, the bound rule was considered outdated and unmanly. They rewrote the rule to get rid of that bound catch in fair territory. But we like it because I love it because it allows everybody to make a play and to contribute to the game action. So no gloves, catching the ball either in the air or on the first bounce. Those are kind of the big ones. We're not allowed to overrun first base like you can in modern baseball, which is tricky to remember as you're running to first that you have to stop. It's a little bit hard on your hamstrings, too, to run as fast as you can and then have to stop on the base. It's kind of an accepted rule that we don't slide into bases, although in the past few years some research has been done that there was actually some sliding. Usually it was a hand-first, head-first slide. Like if you ran past the base, they found a lot of evidence of players would dive back into the base. So a lot of teams and a lot of places like Greenfield Village have relaxed this rule about sliding with the caveat that it's as you're trying to get back to a base and it's hand first. Another big rule difference is the fair foul. In modern baseball, a ball is fair provided it's in fair ground beyond first and third base. If you hit a ground ball down the third baseline, it has to be fair at least until it passes third base itself. The original rule was wherever the ball first hit the ground determined whether it was fair or foul. So if you take a funky swing and you kind of hit it with some English on it and it hits out in front of the plate but spins into foul territory, the way we play, the original rule was that was a fair ball. So that rewards poor hitters like myself, who I don't always hit it very well. Sometimes I'll kind of chop it and it'll land fair and then dribble off foul. That would be a fair hit and I would be able to run. There's actually some people that will attempt to do that on purpose. So if I'm swinging, a normal swing is pretty level. There are some people who will try to chop more like an axe and hit the ball, and their intention is to get it to hit in front of the plate and then go off into fair territory. We call that a chop swing. And actually, it's becoming, like I was saying with the terminology, the lingo, it's becoming something that more and more people are frowning upon. When I started 10 years ago, everybody was doing it. There were two or three people on every team would try to do that. Now, not so many people do it for whatever reason. They found evidence that it wasn't as common. So, but that adds, I think, a very interesting game play that you wouldn't see in modern baseball. And we're so bad, we always forget it, too. You take a swing and you hit the ball poorly, and it does that. It hits fair but goes foul. Your instinct still after playing for so many years is to not run it out, but that's a fair ball. So it's kind of a fun challenge for us to remember all of the rules. Close plays are made on our honor. This is something that I really love about the pastime. We do have an umpire usually. If we don't have an umpire, one of the players will serve as an umpire on a rotational basis. But the spirit of it is that the players themselves make the decisions. If there's a close play, the players will decide who was out. And 99% of the time, it's pretty civil. Yeah. However, anytime you have two teams and a game starts, there is a competitive element that comes out. And there are times when it is advantageous to have an umpire there. Originally, that umpire, in the rules of 1860 that we play by, his job was more to keep the game moving and to kind of enforce the code of conduct, you know, to make sure that you weren't swearing or being nasty to the other team. But he wasn't necessarily making rulings on every play. But that changed over time. And we try to present a competitive game, very competitive game, that doesn't rely on that third party arbitrator. And it works really well most of the time. And I think as a player and as a spectator, it's really a unique and refreshing thing. You'll see a lot of times in a game, you'll see a runner, for example, go into a base and get beaten to the base and know that, and he will call himself out or call herself out. And that's really not something that you would see in modern baseball, in modern sports. You know, if you watch Major League Baseball now, every runner is going to the base convinced that they made it, that they were safe. You know, and their managers tell them, don't leave the base. If it's a close play, don't leave. You'll see at least once a game somebody will say, no, you beat me, I'm out, and they'll exit the field. And it's very civil. And I think that's something that should be more prevalent in modern sports. So I really personally, especially having children, I love that aspect to it. I will say that when we play at Greenfield Village, for example, they've just sort of changed their ruling on this. And they're playing by the rules of 1867, and they have an umpire on hand who's a little more active. So every year we go and play a game where that umpire is playing a little more of a rule, more of a role. What they want you to do at Greenfield Village now is if there's a close play and the players, like if you're running to second base and the ball gets there at the same time and you don't want to leave and the player doesn't acknowledge that you were safe, you call for a judgment from the umpire. So you have to actually say judgment and get the umpire's attention. And at that point, only then will he make a decision on what he saw. And every once in a while, if he didn't see it, he'll ask the spectators, you know, who thinks he was out, who thinks he was safe, just to kind of have fun with it. But, you know, that was before the umpire was the absolute authority. This is, you know, what would happen back then. We don't call balls and strikes. Like I said before, the pitcher's job originally was to deliver a hittable ball. On rare occasions, we'll call strikes if the batter is not swinging at good pitches or the pitcher is not throwing good pitches. And then we come and go out of the game freely. There's no, once you come out of the game, you can't go back in. So it's all very, the spirit of it is friendly competition. Everybody strikes, meaning if you have 15 or 16 players at the game, everybody plays. You just have a long batting order. So it's very inclusive of everybody. Another fun aspect that I referred to earlier was nicknames. I go by Honest John, which was actually given to me after I made a good play for my former team. Somebody said that was an honest play. And so Honest John stuck. A lot of people have a nickname that reflects their profession or personal interest. We've got a gearhead on the team who's a mechanic, auto mechanic. My father goes by Stonewall, a Civil War name, and his name is Peter, so I thought Peter Stone, that makes sense. He's a pretty good defensive player. We've got a hog cooker on our team because he cooks hogs, one of his pastimes. That upper boxer, those are all players on my team in Chelsea. Bottom left are some other colorful names, grass stains, toothpick, barn raiser from other teams. The names on the bottom right are some of our Marys, including Half Pint, Sarah. We've got a cha-cha and a shotgun, and my mother goes by Loose Cannon. The captains of the Marys are Maple Leaf and Trixie. Maple Leaf originally from Canada. But that's just a fun little wrinkle to our pastime. That does have a connection to history. A lot of people back then did go by nicknames. You would see that in the write-ups of games. So we're trying to recapture some of that spirit. Here's some photos of our equipment, and I've brought examples here for you as well to take a look at. We don't use actual bats from 1860s. They would be pretty brittle by then, but according to the rules back then, specifications for a bat were that it be made of wood, that it be round, so not a paddle like you play with in cricket. It had to be round, wood, and it couldn't exceed 2.5 inches in diameter. One of the bats I brought with me is this beast here, and I invite you to come try to wield it after the presentation. Weighs about 10 pounds. And this one would actually, according to the rules, be illegal because of the diameter here. I mean, not only could you not do anything with this because it's so heavy, it would be officially would be illegal. But I do like it because it has these distinctive knobs. Bats did sometimes have a double knob that would force you to choke up like this. And I can barely lift it. But you'll see with some of the other bats, there was no standard style. There was no standard profile for bats back then. We get a lot of our bats from a company down in Ohio called Phoenix Bats, which makes bats for major leaguers, but also they have a whole product line for these vintage teams. This has a mushroom-shaped knob. Another one we got from them has a ball-shaped knob. Usually they're heavier than modern bats, a lot thicker. You can see this one, the barrel is from here to here. I mean, that's pretty much the same thickness for half of the bat. And if you compare that to a modern bat, you can see how narrow that handle is on a modern bat here. If you watch a baseball game on TV or you go to a game, you're probably going to see a few bats shatter during a game. They're just not made as durable as these old style bats, in part because they want to have more bat speed through the hitting zone. They want a narrower handle. They don't want it to weigh much. They want a big striking zone where the balls can actually hit the bat, but they don't want the bat to be too unwieldy. And so if you catch it now in the wrong spot, it's just going to shatter. But we use bats that, because they cost $80 or $90, we hope will last longer than a couple of games. So here's some examples of our bats. The baseballs we use, they are a little bit larger than a modern baseball, slightly softer, but like I said before, they do start out quite hard. When you play with them, you hit them a little bit, they soften up. If they get wet, they'll soften up, but they are slightly larger than a modern baseball. I've got a display here with the anatomy of vintage baseball versus the anatomy of a modern ball. I cut one of our old balls in half. It's actually falling apart here. They come unraveled pretty easy when you cut them. This just has a foam core to it, and it's wrapped in wool yarn. So over time, when that gets wet, or if you hit it a bunch of times, it's really going to soften up. A modern baseball has a cork core to it, two layers of rubber, and it's really wound tight. All of this stuff here is what you would, if you took apart a baseball like I did, this is all the stuff you would find inside of a modern baseball. They say there's more than a mile's worth of string and wool yarn inside of a baseball. Now, modern baseballs all are still handmade. Now, you can watch videos on how baseballs are made. All the balls in a major league in a Tiger game are all hand-stitched. 216 stitches, I think, in them. And a lot of these vintage teams will actually make, not a lot of them, a few of them will actually make their own balls. We get ours from a supplier who does vintage equipment from out in Connecticut. They tend to be a little more durable. But I've played a few games. I actually played one game where a gentleman started at the beginning of the game making, stitching a ball, and then in like the eighth inning, we put that ball into play. So during the game, he made it. It wasn't very good, it fell apart, but it was it was a great effort. Everybody appreciated that. Here's a little bit of our schedule this year. I really hope if you can't come out to see us in Chelsea, you are able to see a game in Dexter. There's clubs in Northville, in Canton. There's a club down by Adrian at Walker Tavern, and Greenfield Village, of course. So there's a little bit of our schedule. We usually play kind of the same teams every year, but I try to schedule a new team or two each year. The Royal Oak team is my former team, great group of guys. They'll be coming to Chelsea in mid-May. In July, we're going to be doing our festival again at Chelsea High School. None of our games and most games that you go to there's no admission. It's kind of a picnic mentality and spirit, so we invite you to come, bring a lawn chair, bring a blanket, bring a picnic lunch, and enjoy a game. That's kind of the spirit of it. Games tend to go a little bit quicker than modern baseball. I think a standard match would be about an hour and a half versus, I think, most major league games are close to 3 hours or so. And it's certainly a lot more affordable. If you've gone to a Tiger game recently, between parking and the ticket and concessions and souvenirs, you can't get out of there under a couple $100. So we invite you to come and take a look at it. I hope I'm doing it some justice talking about it. It really comes to life at a game, and hopefully you can come join us. I do hope to get us back to Ann Arbor this year. Hopefully we can put together another game at Cobblestone Farm, maybe, if the library would like to. We're going to be playing in Saline as part of the Saline Community Fair, and then this Webster Fall Festival at the end of the year is over in Dexter. So there's a lot of local vintage baseball that hopefully you can make. I've included at the end here some nice photos from, these are photos of the Marys. This is actually from a game at historic Fort Wayne in Detroit a couple years ago. This was their first official game. There are the ladies looking pretty tough there. Really was a lot of fun. They were playing the Detroit River Bells, who are based in Detroit at Fort Wayne, and who were the first ladies vintage baseball club in Michigan. And they played a really fun game there. It was pretty competitive, and I think everybody had a great time. We actually played a doubleheader that day. The men played after the ladies' match. And this was played inside of the old Fort Wayne, which if you've ever been to, is really a fascinating place. These teams used to play outside on the parade grounds, which is basically just a flat area next to the fort. But they've started playing inside the fort, and it's a star-shaped fort. It's kind of a smallish field, but it's really fascinating, and you couldn't get a more authentic place to play. The name of the men's Detroit team that's based in Fort Wayne here is the Early Risers, and that was an actual team club from Detroit. There were guys who couldn't play on the Detroit baseball club because of their job. They had to work when the Detroit baseball club would practice. So they got up early and they went to, I believe they went to Campus Martius to play. So they were the Early Riser baseball club because they had to get up early to play. So the Early Risers are a modern team that's been around probably 10, 12 years, and they're resurrecting the original Early Risers, and a great group of guys. There's a couple of photos of my team in action, the monitors. These are great photos taken by a friend of the club, Burl Strong, who's a local treasure in Chelsea, takes some great photos. These are all from a game in Dexter. We play every year at the Civil War days at Gordon Hall. This is from a few years ago. Another very authentic feeling atmosphere. We're actually playing out on crop field here. We just sort of, the farmer who works this land cuts the field before our game, and we throw down some bases and play a game of ball. And it's really a lot of fun. There's Civil War reenactors up on the hill shooting cannons over us. It's a great time. The past 4 years, we played the Dexter Club at this event, Chelsea versus Dexter, and it's really been a great time. And just a few more photos from some games. You'll notice this upper left-hand photo of the Marys. You might recognize the skyline. That's Detroit. That's downtown Detroit. This is a field that we call Navin Field. This is the site of Tiger Stadium that has now been torn down. Originally was called Bennett Park, Briggs Stadium, Navin Field, and then it became Tiger Stadium. Obviously a historic spot. This is where Ty Cobb played, Babe Ruth played, Lou Gehrig. In the past 4 or 5 years, it's been a really fascinating place, not only for groups like ours playing vintage baseball, but for baseball and softball enthusiasts all around the Metro Detroit area. It's been, since they tore down the stadium, it's been kind of abandoned, basically. And about 5 years ago, a group of citizens who called themselves the Navin Field Grounds Crew decided to take care of it. So they come every weekend in the summers, cut the grass, manicure everything, take care of the field, lay down the bases. They really do a fantastic job. But they're trespassing. It's city property, and no one technically is allowed to be on the field. But we've gotten away with it, and they've really done a fantastic job of caring for a site that people have a lot of memories invested in. I grew up going to Tiger games my whole life, and I can remember every birthday I had growing up, I'd go to a Tiger game. And to play on that field is really a special thing. The site has just recently been purchased. It's going to be developed now, so there's a little bit of consternation amongst groups like ours who might not be able to play there anymore, but we have been fortunate enough to have a few games there, including the Marys, and it's really been a treat. So, and now for a little bit of this is the end of my presentation, a little bit of the lighter side. Perhaps as I've been talking, it might sound a little too serious. I try to really have fun with what we're doing. These are some of the end-of-year awards that I make for my players. And I put that on there because it just helps me remember some funny things that have happened in our games. And we really, first and foremost, are trying to have a good time out there. Throughout the season, I'll jot down funny things that happened, and at the end of year party we'll kind of go over the season and celebrate some of those things. You'll see a doghouse here for one of my players who almost skipped his wife's best friend's wedding to come to a game, but at the last minute decided he better go to the wedding. So that was an award for staying out of the doghouse. Our pitcher, who we all love, Crusher, is not the most mobile guy of all time. So unless the ball is hit right to him, he usually doesn't get it. He's got about a 3-foot radius of mobility. So I've given him the most mobile full-time hurler, that's the pitcher, basically because he's our only full-time hurler. And that's him, the Incredible Hulk there, tied down to the ground with screws through his feet. You'll notice the Barbie doll that I took apart. That's one of the terms we have for catcher is the behind. So our best catcher got the best behind. And I think I got another one on there. We had a couple guys, this is from 2 years ago, who we kind of changed their nickname during the game. You'll see behind the doghouse is a little guy with glasses. This is from a game we played down in Ohio. It's kind of a funny moment. He came back in and said, yeah, I just overheard the team saying, he was playing right field. He said, that other team just said, don't hit it to that guy in left, hit it to the dork in right field. So the rest of that game, and the rest of the season, referred to him as the dork in right field. But he's a great player. Here's some of the awards from this year. This is my other son, Henry. I've got a barrel on there. We played a game in Northville last year that was a really amazing game that we won 2-1. Kind of a shorthanded game against a team that we really had no business beating. And we won on a play where one of our players barreled home. He was on third base. Catcher tried to pick him off. Third baseman didn't field it cleanly. Ball got away from him, and he just barreled home, and he was not stopping. And he scored. That was the winning run, 2-1. So that's celebrating that. I made a bobblehead for our player, Hog Cooker, who for 5 years now has taken it upon himself to have the most creative facial hair. You'll notice a lot of players like to look the part as well, including myself. And every year he comes up with a style of facial hair. And in fact, he won. I think I've got this is him here. We played a tournament down in Ohio, and he was voted the best facial hair at the tournament. So this is a lifetime achievement facial hair award, which I also nicknamed the Sorry Courtney Award for his wife, because she's had to live with him and his facial hair. Actually, he goes to the church that we attend to, and we just got our church directory, and a photo of his family, his son, who's also on the team, and two daughters and wife, all look very put together, and he looks like he just sort of stumbled out of the woods. He looks like a caveman. He's got this huge beard. He does not look like he fits with the rest of the family, but great player, great guy, and obviously committed to the spirit of what we're doing. I try to have fun with it. Here's a couple of the funny things. We made a Lego team, my kids and I, last year. So you'll see a lot of personality. And I think what I'm trying to say here is that nobody's taking it all too seriously. It's really, first and foremost, a lot of fun. This is the photo that I just put out here. This is our current roster, our 2016 team that I've swapped heads with a famous photo for, to get people geared up for our current season, which is starting next month, amazingly. And our last photo I put on here as a good way to emphasize the point. This is probably my funniest memory. This is a game we played in Bay City. The Bay City Independence team is one of the best teams in the state. Fantastic, great group of guys, but fantastic players. And this is a game we played in Bay City a couple years ago. I'm not sure we scored, and they scored at least 35 runs. It was not a very competitive game, but my wife was there, my whole family was there, and she told me afterwards that there were some spectators there who just were really vocal about the game and how much fun they were having, and one of them came up to my wife and said, "You know, they're just so good, these guys out there." And my wife said, "Yeah, I know, the Bay City guys are fantastic, aren't they?" And she said, no, those other guys, they're so old, and look at them out there. They're trying so hard." So I was really proud of that. And you see, none of us are really in our prime. We actually have a roster that goes up to 71 years old. I think our average age is close to 50. So it's a really unique pastime, very inclusive, and here we are. So hopefully you've learned a little bit. Hopefully you've enjoyed that. We did just launch a website, chelseamonitors.com, that includes the Marys as well. You can see our schedules there, a lot more photos, a little bit of the history and the rules and so on, in more detail. But I hope you can come out to a game and really see it come to life. So thank you very much. Oh, thank you. Yeah.